This is Karin Zissis of ASCOA Online. A new president, mobile internet, and the revolution's 60-year anniversary. A lot is happening in Cuba. And now, the island is preparing for a constitutional referendum on February 24th, and it'll lead to the creation of private property, habeas corpus, and term limits. On the sidelines of an event in Miami, my colleague Elizabeth Gonzalez chatted with ASCOA's Cuba Working Group head, Alana Tumino, and Florida International University history professor Michael Bustamante about what comes next.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en Foco.
América Latina en Foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
All right, so I'm here with Alana Tumino and Michael Bustamante, who is about to come out with a book on Cuba and the revolution from within in March. So thank you both for coming onto the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
A lot is going on in Cuba, and here in the United States, the headlines have focused very much on Cuba in relation to Venezuela. And perhaps we can get back to that later. But meanwhile, Cuba is actually about to hold a constitutional referendum. And before we get to what is going to change, I'd like to take a look first at the 60-year mark. La Revolución is 60 years old now. So what can we say that the communist system achieved? And what's next?
You want to take that, or?
I'll let you start. I'll start with this one, Mike.
loaded question. I mean, I guess it is the 60-year anniversary of the Cuban Revolution. I think one of the things that I just think about in thinking about these 60 years is whatever you say about the place or the government, this is a political process that utterly reshaped Cuban history, utterly reshaped Latin American history, reshaped the history of U.S.-Latin American relations. It was the prism, Cuba was the prism through which the U.S.-Latin America relationship was understood for so long during the Cold War, and still is in some respects. Although we seem to be getting beyond that a few years ago, now we seem to be back to it. I mean, I think the one Cuban joke that you hear is that the successes of the revolution are healthcare, education, and the failures are breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Right? That I think is a gross simplification of a very complicated story of an economic project and system that has been caught between, on the one hand, the punishing weight of U.S. sanctions as they were intended, and also domestic inefficiencies. And so I think economically, the legacies of the revolution are quite complicated in that respect. And I think people have been thinking about the legacies of the revolution in a particular way since the special period and kind of the question that raised about sort of Cuba's future. I guess what I'm always struck by is how Cuba, no matter what period we're in, or at least since the kind of end of the Cold War, Cuba's always talked about as being on the verge of something or on the cusp of some kind of new phase or new process or new reform. And somehow whatever that next horizon is, I think doesn't always entirely materialize, for good or bad. Whether that next horizon is envisioned as a collapse of the system, which hasn't happened, I don't see it happening, or that next horizon is envisioned as a kind of new mode of, or a sort of definitive mode to a mixed economy that, is much more prosperous than the one that is currently. So I guess I've become a little wary of thinking about Cuba as sort of on the cusp of something all the time and really try to think about it in its, really take its complicated present very seriously.
I think that was a great way to sum it up. And I think what we're seeing now, you know, you mentioned the economy, and what we're seeing now is this: there is a very real effort that we're seeing over the past few years to truly try to open up Cuba's economy to foreign investment, understanding that that's going to be an integral part of growth for them for the future. But there's real difficulties there, both in terms of, you know, from a Cuban perspective and the bureaucracy that entails and the structures, the business structures that entails, also the ability of companies to invest on the island given the geopolitical environment, U.S. policy towards Cuba and other sanctions. And so I think we're seeing that the economy is trying to modernize, is trying to have different elements of foreign investment and a private sector in Cuba, but there remains to be huge challenges to that as well.
And that's one of the changes made in this constitution. The government started the process last year, and then they had citizens give their feedback for that first draft. They made some edits. They finalized it in December, and now a referendum where the public gets to vote yes, no. Some people are boycotting the vote, and we'll get to that. But what kicked off this process? Why did the government decide that now was the right time to reform the Constitution?
In my view, it had to do with the recognition that a kind of process of reshaping, especially the kind of economic order in Cuba, had led to certain realities and certain policy goals that didn't seem to fit, and in fact didn't fit under the purview of what seemed to be allowed, really, by the old constitution. I mean, it's worth noting that the revolution triumphs in 59. There isn't a kind of socialist constitution that officially sort of governs the structure of the state until 1976. There was a sort of fundamental law that had been adopted before that, that was sort of the major, you know, sort of substitute for a constitution. The constitution after 76 did go through a few revisions at different points, most notably after the end of the Cold War, when a lot of the references to kind of Marx and things like that were kind of taken out, and there was more of an emphasis on kind of patriotism. But it's safe to say that this is the most significant reform of the Cuba's constitution since 1976. So on the economic front, you know, what does that mean? It means recognizing in the constitution, and it wasn't there before, that Cuba, you know, that foreign investment has a really important place in the economy. That I think is interesting. There's not a parallel reference to, you know, the need for private enterprise necessarily. So it shows you something about kind of how they think about the balance between those two. There is a recognition in this new draft of the Constitution of more diverse forms of property, including private property, and private property as more than just personal property, as in fact separate from it. And that, I think, sets the stage for, you know, potentially bringing some of the small businesses that have emerged in Cuba under the auspices of quote-unquote self-employment to giving them kind of more legal status. You know, think of it as kind of almost like, you know, corporate status or something like that, or LLC status. Some of those businesses want that kind of legal recognition, and the language of the new constitution seems to open the door for that. But implementing legislation will be required. But the other thing that I think is really salient about the Constitution, and it's not really a reflection of the economic transformations that I mentioned and that Alana was talking about, is a pretty significant restructuring of the Cuban state, you know, kind of at the top executive levels. There is now going to be officially a president of the republic as a kind of new position. There's going to be a prime minister who's the head of the Council of Ministers. And the head of the National Assembly will be head of the Council of State. Previously, all of these positions were consolidated in sort of one person, and officially president as such did not exist, although it was sort of, you commonly refer to the head of state as president.
I would also add, too, is that there seems to be right now a real push to, you know, when you speak with Cubans, when you speak to people from the government, that there's a real effort to try to bring in a younger generation of leaders in ministerial posts. And you're seeing this across from local positions to the National Assembly. And so it feels like there's a movement away of having, you know, all the leaders be 80-somethings in Cuba to really turning towards a younger generation. We're seeing this, you know, in the new president with Miguel Díaz-Canel. You know, he brings in different perspectives. He brings in more youth, being in his late 50s. And that also translates to him coming in with these different ideas and really promoting different ideas that seem to be very important to the population right now. Ideas of, more technology investments and looking at the issues of 3G and broadband in homes. That's something that he has been an advocate for, of this idea of going out and speaking with the people more. There was this whole process of constitutional change. They were very proud of the fact that they were going into communities throughout the year to talk about the draft of the Constitution and to talk about what this could include and to try to, have a dialogue back and forth. And we did see that there was pushback on some issues and not on others, and what came of that. But there does seem to be a sense that there's more dialogue with the population as a whole, and there's this movement away from 80-something-year-olds to younger generations and in different key ministerial posts all the way down.
And one of the stipulations in the articles is that the president can be no more than 60?
It's the age at which you can sort of become president the first time. So there's that. There's the embrace of term limits, right. Following Raul Castro's example. This is something that, if you read Cuban state press reporting on the process of constitutional consultation, that apparently a fair number of people wanted to do away with. They said, why should we have term limits? And I think, I'm not in a position to say how wide that sentiment was really, but I think it's to the Cuban government's credit that they decided to stick to the original plan and keep term limits in. I think
it's a massive departure from having Castro's in there for 60 years, right?
Right. It's a massive departure, and I think it sets up, a really interesting dynamic that will make Cuba's government look more like sort of socialist governments elsewhere around the world today.
I would also add, too, Mike mentioned foreign investment and the idea of bringing foreign investment and actually codifying that, putting that in the Constitution, which is interesting. If I could just take a little step back on that. This is going to be in the Constitution now, but what we've been seeing over the past 10 years is a real economic reform process by which they're trying to diversify their economy and get more foreign investment. They had a new foreign investment law in 2014 that really tried to update and attract more foreign investment. They did different projects like the Mariel Economic Development Zone to really attract different businesses that would have a different joint venture status than before. And so they are trying to raise about $2 billion per year in foreign investment. They every year at Havana's trade fair, they have this portfolio of investment opportunities that they publish with about hundreds of different projects in different areas. Obviously, very state-led projects in energy or agriculture or in a number of different sectors where they actually go out to the community and say, "Hey, these are projects by which we want investment." And so I think they are still actively trying to drum that up, and I think they're emphasizing the importance of that, like Mike said, by putting that in the Constitution.
The other thing I wanted to just touch on with respect to the process of consultation, it's not the first time that the Cuban government engages in this kind of an effort. They did it when the Raul Castro government issued its lineamientos, mm-hmm. To define sort of a new updated political or economic policy above all. But I think, this dynamic of the consultation this time has been interesting. And having read some interesting reporting that a great Cuban media site called El Toque has put out, they have kind of tried to look at what's been published about the kinds of recommendations that were made by the public. That is, authorities seem to kind of group them into certain categories and, try to figure out how many people asked for this change or that change. And based on that information and then comparing that with the actual changes that were put into the final draft, what Etoke concluded was that really most of the changes that were implemented as a result of sort of feedback were at the level of rhetoric, the level of word choice, things that they argued were not as significant as some of the items, right? There were some important changes. One of the more fascinating and I think frustrating dynamics for many was the inclusion in the first draft of an Article 68 that opened the door to same-sex marriage, and then the elimination of that article and substituting it for something that doesn't close the door on same-sex marriage but kind of kicks the can a little bit down the road. There was some opposition to the inclusion of gay marriage in the Constitution on the part of evangelical communities in Cuba. Their mobilization against this article was really quite astounding. I think quite surprising. And many people were asking, you know, how is it that they are so mobilized and others aren't or can't?
In a once atheist state, right?
Right. Right, exactly. And so, you know, the argument has been made that, you know, there is no, that the decision to take out Article 68 and replace it with this other one is not a setback, but it's hard to, there clearly was some reason that they needed to take it out, or they decided to. There was some pressure or concern pressure that they were responding to. So that's one that I think is quite interesting as a dynamic.
One thing that actually surprised me is that this draft actually acknowledges a respect for freedom of expression and thought, despite, you know, maintaining the one-party system. But perhaps the most controversial of these decrees is Decreto 349, which basically addresses cultural crimes. And for example, you know, artists must be licensed in some way from an institution or from the government in order to perform their art. You can't have, I mean, can you have, you know, somebody bring out their guitar and play on the street corners? Would that be allowed? I guess it wouldn't.
Yeah.
How can this paradox exist? Square.
I mean, the Cuban constitution, not only this one, but the previous one, had a fairly robust elaboration of rights, both of political rights, particularly social and economic rights. Some Cuban commentators that I've read and follow have noted the, you know, not just a repeat of things that were already there, but an expansion of certain things. The habeas corpus, for example, which was, my understanding is that it was recognized in Cuban penal code, but now has been sort of raised to the rank of a kind of constitutional provision, which is quite interesting. You know, I think the caveat with all these things is the language that you find that appears to link the realization of these rights to the goals of socialism, right? And so the question is always, you know, what's that dance that happens? Where are their red lines? And so that's why this decree 349, I think, generated so much attention, and rightly so. I mean, it's something that's worth noting kind of is separate from the constitutional process itself. It's not part of the constitutional reform. It came out at a time when the government also issued new regulations on the small business sector. And I think there's a few things that are kind of like feeding into the need to issue this new regulation. I mean, on the one hand, there has been a profusion of non-state sort of spaces in the small business sector, for example. So you have people running bars and they want to hire talent to, you know, play a gig. And that, you know, prior to that, wasn't really kind of part of things. I think there's a certain kind of cultural impetus to this, the kind of profusion of cultural forms, and I'm going to go ahead and say it, reggaeton, as this kind of bugbear of a certain kind of cultural conservatism. And wondering why is it, you know, this is the case that's always referenced in the press. If I bring my kid to eat a pizza, like I've got to see a music video, blah, blah, blah. You know, it reminds me of sort of the debates between Tipper Gore and Dee Snider of Twisted Sister in the 80s about sort of like parental advisory label, you know, those hearings. I don't know if you've ever seen those clips. They're great. Frank Zappa is amazing in that. But so there's this kind of like in this question about indecency that is part of this debate. But the other thing that you rightly acknowledge is this link between the apparent inclusion in this regulation that if you want to be hired to play a gig, you have to it has to be sort of done through a kind of agency to which you as an artist might belong. And I think the state has since come back and said, this is not that much. We're not going to go crazy. They've even said that they're going to kind of roll out the implementation of this slowly in some respects.
It seems like the government is being very kind of careful in saying, we are not trying to censor what you can create, But we are saying if you then want to present that work, that you have to have this special authorization in order to do that. And so it seems like they're both getting away with saying, no, this is not censorship. This is not us telling you that you can't do this. However, you do have to have an authorization then to present that work. And so I think a lot of artists are saying, well, yes, that is censoring what I'm able to do. And they've even detailed what you can and cannot produce in these different pieces of art. So I feel like a lot of folks from the art community in Cuba are feeling that is, you know, very unjust and very unfair, while at the same time it does make sense in some cases that the government will want to start creating regulations around a sector that is now presenting itself, you know, that didn't have regulations surrounding it before. So there's definitely this push and pull there that's happening there. This is something that is of huge concern to the artist community in Cuba. I think it's making actually less headlines here in the United States, but I think this is a very big topic.
People have gotten in trouble for speaking out against it, like Tania Bruguera, the renowned international artist that's Cuban, and she was arrested temporarily when she was trying to, you know, voice opposition to this decree.
This is a process that's in motion. I think in recent weeks it's been, you know, the fervor of that debate seemed to hit most, I think, kind of late last year. Other things have seemed to have overshadowed it a bit since. And the only other thing I would add is I think the other driver of this, you know, very much overlaps with some of the impetus for small business sector reforms that we've seen rolled out, which is about tax avoidance, if I'm being blunt, right? The artist sector is also a sector that is, you know, is not just art for the sake of art. There's business to be done, and that is done. And to the extent that there were kind of more independent channels for doing this work and selling art and things like that, you know, the example I always use is, you know, for if you ever waited tables, you know, did you declare all your tips? You know, I hope the IRS isn't listening. But I think part of this regulatory framework was conceived with that in mind, right? That you know, we can document what you're doing and you can pay your fair share of taxes, which is not, you know, an uncommon refrain in our own politics. So it's all of these kinds of impulses that are converging, I think, that have made this debate so sharp.
So I think, concluding from our discussion, we can say that there are some very positive changes in this constitution. There are also maybe some more controversial or paradoxical ones. People have the option to vote yes, no, some will stay home. I think that for people that don't want what is being proposed, that would like a multi-party system, that would like to directly elect their president, it seems like they don't really have a way forward, because if you vote no, it's continuity. If you vote yes, it's continuity. So what is the right decision? If you wanted change, what do you do?
I'm not going to presume to speak for Cubans' choices. I agree that the way the choice has been framed is constrained, but I don't think that's a surprise either. I've seen an interesting debate about, you know, if you vote no, what does that really mean? You know, are you just in fact kind of ratifying the old order, which wasn't any better anyway, or are you, you know, is it a vote of conscience? And I think Cubans are going to vote how they feel. I have no doubt that the referendum will pass. For me, that's not in question. The campaign in favor of the referendum is, you know, very active. You know, on Twitter, on Facebook, you know, I've seen photos of buses that kind of have the "Yo voto sí" kind of thing. So I don't mean to say that the results are a foregone conclusion, but you know, I think that's probably the direction that it's leaning. It doesn't mean that vote yes is entirely insignificant either. I think what is going to be interesting to watch is, given that this is the framework that's been established and that is in all likelihood going to be passed, there is a whole slew of kind of implementing legislation that needs to follow to make active some of the measures that are there and that maybe some people see as more hopeful. Is there still the possibility for mobilizing for other kinds of complementary laws that don't have to do with the Constitution per se, but have to do with recognizing a space for non-state media, updating the sort of law of associations to reflect a kind of broader panoply of civil society organizations that exist? That, I think, is kind of the nature of where people seem to be placing their attention.
I would add as well that I was actually just talking with a friend of mine last week who is a Cuban who runs a paladar in Havana. And I was asking her, oh my gosh, this is this big deal, this new constitution and this vote. And she said to me, Alana, I guess this is a big deal, but no, I'm more concerned of what's happening. You know, my restaurant isn't as full as it used to be, and started talking to me about U.S. policy, then was talking about the new regulations for the private sector. So while I think, yes, this is a very big deal in terms of having a new constitution, I think for some of the people that I've spoken with on the ground, kind of in their day-to-day lives and what they're doing, haven't actually really been that focused on this and maybe weren't as involved in some of the different discussions that happened throughout the year because there wasn't a sense in their mind that anything huge was changing in Cuba. Okay, yes, we have this new constitution, but it's probably going to be a lot more of the same. And that's kind of the feedback that I was getting from some of the folks on the ground that I know, whereas I was watching this very closely and unfolding and seeing all these different steps, she absolutely wasn't following it as closely as I was and had these kind of other priorities of, okay, making enough money at her paladar and what's going to happen, you know, what happened with some of those changes and the pushback they had and some of the proposed regulations for that sector.
Yeah, resolviendo the day-to-day problems. Yeah. What's interesting also is that this part of this debate is taking place on the internet, just as Cubans are getting the first taste of 3G, mobile internet, and some of them even in their homes. How do you think that has changed the conversation?
I think it's huge. I think the rollout of 3G and broadband is really being welcomed with people on the ground in Cuba. This is something that has been talked about for a long time. Cuba laid out their own national development plan for broadband and connectivity. And they have been, you know, talking about really rolling this out for a long time, and we're finally seeing that happen. And I think it's a very big deal. You know, usually when you're walking around the streets of Havana, you have a downloaded map already. Nothing is in real time. You know, developers and app developers had amazing solutions to get around that in terms of the app creation, in terms of, you know, downloading information so you have it because you couldn't be up, you know, downloading that in real time. And so I think this is a very big deal. People are welcoming it, and we've even talked about how when we talk about you know, different sectors that can really benefit from this, like programmers.
I mean, I have seen a fair amount of grumbling about the cost of the service, which is not surprising.
Yeah.
I've seen, you know, alternating reports about the quality of the 3G service. You know, some weeks it seems to be great, and other weeks, and, you know, I guess to a certain extent that's expected. They're rolling out this major infrastructure change. I think one thing I try to follow this, right, and I see whether it's on Facebook or Twitter, you know, Cubans engage very much in a kind of back and forth with one another, whether it's on the Constitution or all kinds of other stuff. I mean, the other thing is that Díaz-Canel has now basically ordered every minister and thereon to get on Twitter. And so people are, you know, saying, you know, they'll take a picture of something that they see in a state-run store, for example, that doesn't appear to be in order, then they'll, like, tweet it at the minister, you know? And I don't know to what extent, I think it's too soon to say whether that kind of feedback, what kind of results it's having. Anecdotally, and I've seen a few interesting examples, but I think the other thing I ask is, or I wonder, is something I wonder about, you know, our own politics in the United States. You know, what happens in the virtual sphere? Does that translate to the streets, so to speak, or to everyday life, really? I mean, I think because of the cost, while people are welcoming 3G, you know, without a doubt, and people are plugged in and on Facebook and whatever, you know, I don't know as if it's an equal playing field where people have the time or the money to spend their time on the internet, you know, engaging in political debate or a conversation, where versus dialing, one sister in Miami on Emo or something, right? So I wonder about that. What is what I see happening in the virtual sphere? How much does that translate? What kind of impact does it really have? You know, is the internet this space for pluralizing conversations in a kind of utopian way, or is it a curse in some respects? You know, right. I don't know, but I think you know, Cuban society is entering that dynamic.
I mean, Cuba has typically been behind, you know, technological innovations, but Díaz-Canel being their first social media president is kind of right on time with what's going on in the rest of the region, where you have all these other presidents that have this big social media presence. That's kind of one case where they've caught up.
It is. It's interesting to see in terms of, you know, you were saying the different ministers and the Twitter accounts. It's, you know, it's all of a sudden you're getting all of these Twitter messages from all these different ministries and hearing in real time, you know, and other Cubans as well. But especially from that point of view, it's an interesting development.
It bears mentioning. I mean, there's an official, there's like, you know, a number of kind of hashtags that have become widely circulated with respect to the constitutional reform or other things going on. And I think one of the ones that I've just thought about as really kind of interesting and also strange in a way is this hashtag Somos Continuidad, which is We Are Continuity. That has been, you know, if there is a slogan of the Díaz-Canel government, it is that. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, the intention is clear, transmitting an image to the world that we are not, because I'm younger or new or whatever, this is not a rupture of any kind from the revolution, from the sort of the historic goals and commitments. But it is a kind of ironic sentiment in a way to define a revolution, which by its definition means change in terms of continuity, mm-hmm. right? And that just reflects very much a paradox in Cuban society widely, right? So it's interesting to see some of those things now manifest themselves on social media.
Well, thank you for that segue, because the next thing I was going to ask you guys is exactly how Díaz-Canel might be departing from some older, you know, school of thought. I've heard that maybe the National Assembly, or at least the, you know, the older revolucionarios that are still around, don't see him in the best light.
I think there's always, you know, just like there was Kremlinology, trying to figure out who's in, who's out. I have not seen any evidence of anything but a kind of rallying behind the new figure of Miguel Díaz-Canel. I think he is in a difficult position, not only the question of sort of assuming the mantle of from the históricos as the kind of guy of the new generation and all that that entails, but I mean, literally, I was thinking about this over the past year. Cuba had a devastating plane crash. It was a devastating tornado a couple weeks ago, and literally a meteorite just fell out of the sky. That is those are you know, if you believe in omens, those it's a tough hand, right? Add to that a worsening climate with the United States, which we'll get to. Add to that the complications of Venezuela and what that means for Cuba's economy. I mean, this guy legitimately has a difficult job, and so he's been. What I've noticed in terms of differences is someone who's been very out in public. Almost in a way that harkens back to Fidel Castro, as opposed to Raul Castro, who was more reserved. Miguel Díaz-Canel is not giving long speeches like Fidel Castro did, but I remember the plane crash when that happened. I mean, he was there on scene. Clearly, he is the public face of the government. I mean, I think there's always this kind of scuttlebutt about, well, you know, who really, you know, runs the ship of state. I think my own view is that it's pretty clear that he has a certainly a leading role, or the leading role, you know, albeit one that now is going to be complemented by someone who's going to be a prime minister and someone's going to be the head of the Council of State. And again, how that kind of more collective leadership structure works out, if you like, you know, I don't have any way to predict how it's going to work out, but again, just an interesting dynamic.
Fidel is sending messages from the heavens, apparently.
Maybe.
Okay, so then, you know, circling back to this idea of, you know, 60 years of the revolution, and one of the intentions was to export the revolution. And we have that playing out in Venezuela right now. Do you think that this will ultimately end up in a break of ties between the Maduro government and Cuba?
The relationship with Cuba and Venezuela has historically been very strong. Those ties were never closer than with Chavez and with Fidel, and that relationship remains very strong. Remains clear that Cuba is going to continue to be a close ally of Venezuela. Now, with everything happening, there's some reports saying that relationship isn't as strong as it used to be, but that it is clear that the posturing of Cuba right now is that they are not going to leave their friend Venezuela in their time of great need, and that they will still remain very close partners. There are still a lot of Cubans in Venezuela. There's about 31,000 Cubans in Venezuela right now, 22,000 Cuban doctors, which is also a big source of revenue for Cuba, probably in the ballpark of potentially $5 billion or so dollars. They still get oil from Venezuela. That's going down about 50,000 barrels of oil per day, which is half of what it was just a few years ago. So that's going down. So I think as Cuba's economy is contracting and they're trying to introduce different austerity measures, and a big benefactor like Venezuela is not there to support them as often, that could, I think, make that relationship more difficult. From an outside point of view, though, and from just statements that you're seeing and conversations you're having with Cubans, they're standing very close with Venezuela in this time.
Very hard to predict at this point what will happen in Venezuela. I think it's safe to say that the bet of the move of Guaido to claim the interim presidency, and then of a significant portion of international community to recognize him, seemed to be a bet that was tied to a short time frame, i.e. doing something that would potentially have a quick, have its desired effect from their point of view in a quick time frame. And so there's a real question in my mind of, as this standoff drags out, which side does that favor? Does that push Maduro further against the wall? Does it actually start to break some of the international support that we've seen behind the alternative? I mean, I think it's safe to say that Cuba has a lot on the line here economically, the oil ties and everything else. And so it's not surprising in a way to see Cuba, be all in on supporting the Maduro government. There's not really, to my mind, much of a thinking in terms of realpolitik, right? There's not really a strategic alternative.
Certainly be an interesting year for both countries. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis. Elizabeth Gonzalez produced this podcast. For more about ASCOA's Cuba Working Group, visit as-coa.org/Cuba. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. Learn about upcoming concerts at musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If so, please write us a review and subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, or SoundCloud.